So a lot of people reach out to me and say, Steph, I want to fight in the culture war. I want to save Western civilization. Well, I'm here to tell you that if you want to fight in a war, you must understand the laws of combat. You must understand the art of war. And luckily, you've come to the right place. You've come to the ultimate gigachad in intellectual, philosophical war. You're in the cavern of the genius. The samurai of philosophy is sitting right in front of you. So if you want to fight for Western civilization, you've got to understand that when you get in a fight, there's a very important thing not to be. So this is called being reactionary. You should not react, because if I'm in a boxing match with you, the thing I want you to do is react to me. I want to walk out and I want to throw a punch at you, jab you, and make you get all kind of flustered, and then you're gonna unconsciously, without thinking, throw a punch back to try to get rid of me. And this is what I do. I try to predict those punches. I try to goad you, tease you, annoy you, poke at you to make you do stuff, and then you throw that big punch and I slip back and counterpunch you and knock you unconscious. You can see this too. Many great fighters do this. Muhammad Ali, Floyd Mayweather, Conor McGregor, all brilliant counterpunches. And their strategy is dependent upon their opponent's reactions. And they use the opponent's aggression and reactions against them to generate more force. If I punch you a normal way and you're prepared for it, that's one thing. But when you attack me and I punch you back, that's so much more powerful. Now, intellectually, in the world of ideas, reactionary behavior is present as well. It's something you should always watch for. In fact, the reason why many of us want to save Western civilization is because of a very smart and honest man, Jordan Peterson, who kind of stood up there the last while and started to say that there's something sort of wrong in the world. There is a culture war happening. And 10 years ago, no one really cared about Western civilization. But Jordan Peterson comes along and various movements around that kind of sparked this energy inside of a lot of us and sort of said, you know, all is not right in the state of Denmark. Things are getting a little bit crazy out there. Something's changing, something's going wrong. And so what happens is we all started to react against the current trends. In fact, Jordan Peterson himself was someone from back in the 70s and 80s, had been studying Western civilization for a long period of time. And around about the 2010s or whatever it was, he had been in decades in the university system. But around about that time, he sort of started to react. He started to get the hunches that there was something up. Something was dramatically changing. The culture was dramatically changing and causing some surprising responses in him. I guess the way you could think about it is that he probably felt like someone in pre-Marxist or pre-communist Russia, and he noticed people popping up who were chanting the tarantula's words, as Nietzsche would say. The preachers of equality had become superordinate, and their ideology was now starting to spread to the kids, spread to the people around them. And the culture, that is to say the sort of experience of life in university, was starting to take a very, very drastic and radical shift, and Jordan thought it was a bad thing. So he puts his foot down and he says, all right, let's start talking about this stuff. And of course, this hypes an awful lot of people up. He voices the voiceless for an awful lot of people. And then boom, out of this, you get this massive reactionary movement, this explosive reactionary movement. Now, this is not necessarily a bad thing. I'm not sort of turning around and going to say something like, you know, you should be like Buddha all the time, waiting in perfect alignment, ready to strike or ready for anything. So if someone starts punching you, you know, and you start reacting, that's necessarily bad. It's very natural that when someone begins to assault you, when someone commits war upon you, when they try to take your culture and claim it from you, it's natural for you to react. It's natural for you to try punch back, and sometimes that can even be good because it'll get you space and get them at least kind of doubting themselves on some level. But if you truly want to talk about war, if you truly want to talk about conducting and waging something like this, engaging in a culture war, you must think beyond reaction. You must be the counter striker. You must be the person with a strategy. Because what you see often is what's happening with Conor McGregor or Floyd Mayweather. They're sitting down and they're thinking about their opponents like chess. They're thinking 10 steps ahead of their opponents. They're reasoning from first principles about the task in hand. They look at the fight. They look at these two people standing up and they say, this guy's going to try to throw a big overhand right. And so Connor's planning out a counterpoint to that, a counterattack to that. He's planning for the reactions. He's thinking ahead. He's thinking from first principles and he's focused on victory. He's not focused on reacting. Now, this is something you do not see in the realm of culture much. And this is what we're going to talk about today. Now, the big question you should ask, instead of being reactionary, is how to think upon first principles about what is culture. We'll talk maybe about waging war on culture, but you can't understand what a culture war is without first understanding the principles of what is culture. And culture is many things. In the simplest level possible, culture is the right hemispheric felt experience of life that you live through when you go about your day. What is it like to live? How much of a meaningful and intoxicating experience is it to wake up and actually go through the sequence of events that make up your normal day-to-day life, and how much is that filled with purpose and beauty, and how much of an art is your life? You can think about the experience of a farmer 700 years ago. And nowadays, we make this very interesting, arrogant choice where we say, for example, our lives are better because we have televisions and we have advanced medication that can help us with niche surgeries, high trauma surgeries and stuff like this. And we have space flight and we have cars. And we assume that we are, for some reason, better than some, you know, ignorant, illiterate farmer who lived in Sicily and just harvested wheat and pork and ate pasta all day along with, you know, whatever kind of crazy mincemeat they make down there or something like that, and walked around speaking Italian. But the thing is that is their life, is their felt experience, what would that be like? What would the experience of their life be like? They would wake up with the sun. Their hormones would be in sync with their circadian rhythms. Everything is working correctly. Their pineal gland is sparked. There's no fluoride in their water. They're getting up. They're walking outside into their village and they're talking to 150 people that they all know intimately. They have a girl that they've been married to since they were young. And there's no problems. Well, maybe they're Italians. Maybe there's a little bit of cheating going on, whatever. But it's all good. You know, they get over it. They figure out ways to get over it. They've got music that they all make together, and it's their ancestral music to have for hundreds of years. They eat food that grew out in their back garden. There's no need to go to Whole Foods to buy organic stuff because it's all there. They've got a dog that they've raised themselves. They're 22 years old and they've like taken on many, many responsibilities in life. They might even have their own house that they're building and all this stuff. And the felt experience of their life would not be that bad. In fact, this is quite famously shown in like studies and stuff like that about people in Sicily who live very long because their lives are very relaxed. There's a great experience of life, and the food quality is quite high, and their diets are high, and they've just got a lot of things going for them. And the experience of that is significantly good. It's a good experience. Now, compare this to our modern life where you go out and you wake up in the morning to a beeping alarm and all that cortisol dumps immediately because you're like up until 2 a.m. last night staring at your phone and like flicking through Tinder because you're alone. And then this beeping alarm comes up, you get a cortisol dump from your adrenals, you wake up, you knock back a coffee on an empty stomach, the probiotics in your stomach get messed up, you start to get like a little bit anxious for this reason as well, you get the coffee jitters, you hop in your car, maybe you walk, whatever it is, you put on your headphones, you listen to Joe Rogan talking to you about something, and then you're like switching to things, like only paying half focus, you eat some crappy like made up meal that you've like bought because you're reading about like there's nutrition in it or something like this, or maybe like a quick meal or something like this. You go to your work, you sit down, hunch over, bad posture, spend 8 hours a day wrapped up like Gollum sitting on a screen writing about things, or complaining about the state of the world, writing about how we need to change the world and we need to change culture because you're unhappy, because your body is full of inflammation. You live in this present experience of hell, and so you want to see the world transform into something that would be more ideal. And essentially, you abstract out a ideology to explain to yourself that you need to escape from your reality without understanding that your main problem is that the actual reality around you, perfectly in your control, is something that you need to take responsibility for if you want to escape. But nonetheless, this is what you sort of postulate as your lived experience, your life. You could say your culture. And there's a lot of things that go into this. It would take me a lot of videos to be comprehensive about this. All the little tiny details really count to it. But this is one of the key aspects to understanding culture. You have to approach culture like an artist. You, in fact, have to approach life like an artist to understand culture. And what many people make the mistake of doing is they approach life like an ideologue. They approach life like an abstraction. Now, it's not that abstractions and ideals have no place. We're going to talk about that next. But it's important to be able to hold against this. In fact, this is probably the key to Nietzsche's philosophy that most people miss out on because they're not as much of a philosophy samurai as I am. They are not able to see what Nietzsche's trying to say is that you always come across people in your life, Christian or modern or progressive, whatever you want, or like conservative, anybody, you'll always come across people who are not able to engage with the true lived felt experience of life and actually fight the war there, because it's their life sucks and it's hard. Their experience of life is inflammation, cortisol, stress, inadequacy, feelings of doubt, all these type of things. Their actual lived experience, if you just map out their day, not what they talk about, none of the abstractions, just the actual lived experience, is hell, is literal hell. And this is a very Buddhist idea, is literal hell. And they're trying to, what they do is they can't deal with that. They can't face it. It takes discipline and effort to fix your diet. It takes discipline and effort to admit that you're an abrasive person that it struggles to make friends. It takes discipline and effort to understand that, you know, maybe you're getting rejected by girls because you're not good enough or something like this, or you're not working yourself hard enough. It takes discipline and effort to be serious about your work and be serious about your job. It takes an awful lot of things that are hard to do in order to change your actual reality around you. So what we often tend to do is escape into ideals. We escape into abstractions. We sit down and say, you know, how about I think? How about I create a ideology of how the world should change that is perfect for me? And this is escapism, if you want to talk about it this way. And this is a very, very bad signal. This is a signal of someone who refuses to do what is needy and necessary. It refuses to do the costly effort to change reality. And this is often one of the greatest signals of bad culture. One of the most dangerous things that you can see is crazy abstract idealism. Crazy escapism is the way you could say it. And it's a very jarring thing for most people, because I'm like a guy who talks about ideas. Me and you are in the realm of ideas. We're talking about abstractions. And we tend to be the most prone to this. We tend to be the people who are most likely to escape our reality. And we struggle with our reality. But that's why our job is so important, because if we've got that capacity to think abstractly, we can poison everyone else, because we might be better at talking than most people. We're like a cell that could be a benefit to the body, or it could be a cancer to the body. We'll be able to spread ideas more efficiently. But of course, if we're not disciplined, if we're not philosophers of the future, if we're not well-trained priestly types, we can't ground our thinking in reality and understand the true nature of our problem and the true nature of the problem of life and the true nature of helping people. And we can harass them with ideology and blatherbraining, and this actually puts them in a terrible place. This brings them down, fills their head with nonsense while their lives around them rot and turn into crap. And what you notice all the time is that as cultures fall, they tend to become more ideological. This is now, again, a very Nietzschean statement, but you see it, for example, now. An awful lot of our felt experience is dramatically crumbling, dramatically falling down, and our ideological purity is rising because we are running away into abstractions. We want to change our reality. And of course, we're not going to do the discipline thing, which is actually fix it. So we run off into these ideologies, run off into these abstractions. And this stuff can happen in hundreds of different ways. It can happen, for example, you could be a Christian, and a Christian can run off into Christian Puritanism and ideology. That happens often. But you can also have Christians that are happy hypocrites, that live a very good lived experience, and religion is well integrated into their lives, and they work with it properly, and they're absolutely fine. And this is more to do with human nature than any way of abstracting your way out of this. You can't escape these realities by blatherbraining and debating. This is the key. Now, with that being said, let's talk about the other angle of culture, which is the actual role ideals have in it. Now, with all that being said, I'm suggesting in a very Buddhist way that there's no escape. You cannot escape the actual nature of the problem, which is the felt experience of your real life existence right in front of you. And it's the one thing, you're like a dog who's after eating a pillow or something like that, or pooping on the floor, you know, and your owner comes in and points at the pillow or points at the poop, and you're just like, I don't want to look. It's like, who pooped? Who ate the pillow? And you're like, ugh. That's like you and your life. This is what a culture turns into when life is hell, when it has failed. Life, the experience of life is like, I don't know, something else. It has to be something else. It has to be ideology. And in truth, It's not that ideology has no place. And there's a couple of angles of this. First of all, in the simplest level possible, human nature is human nature. We've all got these big left hemispheric noggins on top of us. We're never going to not be ideologues. This is the way we think. This is the way we operate. Now, we certainly need to learn how to temper it. We need to learn how to tame it, which is, you know, what Buddhism is all about. But at the same time, it's not like we're ever going to get rid of it. We just have to understand its context. Now, this comes down to our question about, all right, well, how do you deal with ideals? How do you deal with visions of the world, visions of how things should be? Because this is ultimately what happens with ideals. This is ultimately what happens in a culture, usually. We all live in life, and the whole universal principle is that to live is to suffer, to live is to struggle. And we often want to escape our realities, or at the very least, escape to something more pleasurable and the simplest human experience and mechanism that you can have. You want to go somewhere else, and we struggle with gratitude all the time. Now, there's a lot of different answers to this, but some of the most simplest ones are, you know, the religious questions, and this is why religions are so tied to good culture, because they temper the emotions of the individual and get them to engage with life around them. So, for example, the religion of Buddhism is trying to grab that propensity inside the individual to try escape into ideology or nonsense or the hell of their mind, and try to grab them and pull them down to this vision of Buddha, the Messiah, who sits down and welcomes in the world and radically accepts the reality around him as it is, and lets go of all that nonsense and all that chasing, and he gets out of the cycle of samsara, and he actually solves the problem of suffering by learning to accept and embrace reality as it is, and find joy in the little things, you know, as unromantic that it is, that's something. And Buddha becomes an ideal for that reason. In Christianity, the exact same principle. Christianity is about sitting down, well, maybe close, maybe not the exact same, sitting down and looking at Christ and understanding that he is a man who accepted reality fully for what it is. He was a man who lived and accepted his destiny, his fate, his amor fati. And we all want to see, we want to struggle and see ourselves escape reality and become these great heroes, or become change reality and do all these type of things. But Christ is almost like the anti-hero. Everything about his life is a failure in some sense, yet he has the ultimate success. He wins your heart, but he dies. He doesn't conquer any empire, he doesn't conquer any nations, he gets crucified, he's treated as a prisoner, spat upon, and all this, but he still wins. And in some sense, it's about showing you that there's dignity in the small victories, the victories of your life, of dealing with, facing the suffering straight on. And this, again, is another ideal. Now, these are great answers. These are really, really powerful for pulling people's heads out of the cloud and getting them to confront the problem, which is suffering, which is the stuff right in front of you, and getting you to wrestle with it properly. But as we said, and especially nowadays, you know, we don't have strong ideals. People are struggling with Christianity. People are struggling with Buddhism, although they're trying. People are struggling with a lot of things. And so, even if you're like atheist or whatever, you're still going to have this religious function, this need to find an ideal to that explains to you how to deal with your life. And so what you see on, you could say, the political left, or maybe the cultural left, is an interesting set of ideals rise up. The ideals of how the world should be to solve the problem of suffering. The vision of what is the right way to live. The vision of what is good. And this gives you this sort of idea that, and this is very abstract, this is its mistake, and this is why it's wrong on deep philosophical first principles. The abstractions are equality and freedom. People call them liberals, you know? And this is interesting, because you, and this is why I'm kind of bringing this up, a lot of people come into me and they talk to me about a culture war, and when I say something like equality and maybe freedom, you probably believe those ideals deep down. You probably actually want those. And this is why you're in a reactionary state, because you've never taught this stuff true, like, for example, Friedrich Nietzsche has. And so you're someone who sits down and says to yourself, all right, I don't like the left. They're crazy. What do I stand for? Now, if you stand for equality and freedom, you're pretty much not far off them. And the answer you have to suffering is close to this. You offer people an abstraction. If people suffer, you say to them stuff like, well, you live in the West, which is free, and you're equal to fail in this capitalist world, and that's good, and that's justified. That justifies your pain, that justifies your struggle. And you have some very, very interesting problems there, because is that equal in relevance to Jesus Christ? Is that really going to stand up to the fore? is saying that, like, you're all equal to fail as everybody else. Is that really going to answer someone's struggle? This is actually a very big problem with an awful lot of the right-winger stuff. Like, you know, maybe in the 1950s, saying to someone, you know, you live in America, that great nation, and you can go to a factory job and support a family, like, on one wage or something like this, maybe that people could digest that idea of equality and freedom. But nowadays, the idea of equal opportunity to participate in the workforce means being stuck in an Amazon warehouse delivering crap to a lot of people that you, like, you just don't believe in those jobs anymore. That's not victory, and you're getting crucified on minimum wage and stuff like this. It's not. And then you think from a felt experience of that, that's not, where's the justice in that? Where's the true engagement with life? You feel like you're getting screwed over. You feel resentful. You feel spiteful. You feel like you're losing or something like this. And a lot of people are trying to escape those jobs, and they run off into things like cryptocurrency and all this, whatever. And so people like on the left, what they're sort of saying, what they're sitting down and doing, the ideal that they're promoting is equality taken to its logical conclusion, where we strip wealth from the top, where we strip boundaries and we strip responsibilities from everybody and give absolute freedom to the individual and absolute equality. And they're just going all the way at this stuff. They're following the ideals to their logical conclusion. In some sense, this is what communism was. And people really struggle with this, because they, when they talk about something like a culture war, they really struggle with this idea. Because the left are, in some sense, doing it right. The left are the people who are truly representing the ideals of the modern age, if you're going to stand for abstractions. And if you're going to deal with the problem of suffering and have to come up with some type of explanation, the values, the ideals, the things that you can say to people when they're down there in the dumps, before you would have come to them with Christ, but now what you're going to come to them is, say, equality and freedom. And nowadays, when someone's suffering because they're in an Amazon warehouse and they're inflamed and they feel their life sucks, and someone like Vaush shows up and explains to them equality and freedom, and he says, our plan is to fully see these visions appear in reality. Our plan is to take equality and freedom and make them happen absolutely. Not like the conservatives who just tamper about with bullshit and are probably get manipulated by powerful people. Instead, we're going to make this stuff happen, and what will happen is your experience of life will change. You see what they're promising? They're promising how you can get out of hell and enter into a heaven of better experience. With the redistribution of wealth, you'll have more money and you'll be more economically viable. With the liberation of social norms, you'll be able to have more sexual experiences and you'll therefore be happy. Now, you might not agree with those premises, but this is the offer, and it makes sense to people, and it speaks to their emotions, and it gives them a way to escape the suffering of their life. But it doesn't lead to good culture, because as always, escapism leads to bad culture. In fact, the only way to create good culture is to go in the opposite direction, is to go towards a realism and illiberalism and confronting life properly. And this is what we're going to talk about now. And so the correct answer to the culture war, when you boil it down to these first principles, and you see that the first problem is the problem of suffering. And how do you create a life that is most anti-fragile to the problem of suffering? And I don't mean happiness. This is also a mistake an awful lot of people mean. I mean being able to accept your reality around you. And religions come up with good answers to this, and communisms, they come up with persuasive answers to this. You can't deny them is the most important thing. But ultimately, there's you look at what they're offering, and it boils down maybe in some sense to escapism an awful lot of the time. There's definitely virtues in them all, but it's a kind of mixed bag, we'll put it this way. Now, what is the correct way to confront reality is what someone like Nietzsche is talking about, because he's suggesting that the ideals you can offer people, when you sit down with someone and they're in a state of pain and they're in a state of suffering, they're like Gollum sitting on the ground and they're like, I hate this reality. And when there's a lot of people like that, it means there's something wrong with your society. It means your culture sucks, and the experience of going out and talking to these people is a shitty culture. These people are inflamed, unhealthy, incompetent, not put together, and it's all bad signals if you think about it this way. You can think of it like animals. If you go in, like, where does the word culture come with a bacteria culture? You go in and look at your little petri dish, and if all the bacteria are like nasty golem bacteria that are all unhappy and full of inflammation and poisonous, you're like, that's a bad culture. You go into this other bacteria and they're all healthy Chad bacteria, all bodybuilding and all this, you're like, oh, that's a good looking culture. That culture's doing all right. Now, this is a very materialistic way of seeing things in some sense, but that doesn't mean that it is restricted to a low way of seeing the world. What we're talking about here is the idea of true strength, true happiness, and true success. Basically, you suffer because you are weak. And the strong is the person who is most anti-fragile to suffering. Your ability to overcome suffering is your ability to overcome life itself and become strong and become healthy and therefore become happy. And in fact, in order for you to become strong, you're going to have to overcome yourself in so many ways that it's going to make you a better person. It's going to make you a better character. It's going to make you a more ideal person. It's going to make you someone who you would want to be around. In order for you to become strong, you have to fix, for example, physiological things and mental things. You have to develop discipline, humility. No one's going to go and get strong and not get humbled, because they'll notice their weakness, and this will actually break them and show them what they are. And then they'll rationally ground themselves to reality, humble themselves to reality, and have to develop strength in alignment with reality, and they won't get the result unless they do it right. And that will humble them. That will humble them an awful lot more than someone who sits around and wanders into abstractions the whole time. And this ultimately leads to the big idea, is that once you are strong, once you are married and adapted to reality, and you engage with that properly, and you do the right things to engage with that, and you discipline yourself to reality, and you gain strength, you gain the benefit of health and strength that makes you anti-fragile to suffering. And this is so interesting about life. Life rewards you not just with strength, but with beauty. We always see beauty as strength as beauty. We always see what is strong as beautiful. They're deeply, deeply related. Now, they're not perfectly related, and we'll get to that in a moment, but they're deeply related. So the strong are always majestic. They always have an intoxication to them. And ultimately, a culture of strong people is a beautiful culture. And this is a very interesting problem, because you don't get, Nietzsche says this in one of his best passages, beauty is not something that you can just talk about. Beauty is not something you can just wish into existence. You can't abstractly blather to people about beauty. You can't talk about ideology. I can't talk to you about equality and tell you I'm going to change the world and make you beautiful. I can't talk to you about freedom and change the world and make you beautiful. You could give me the reins of society and I could overhaul all of society under the name of equality or freedom or liberalism, but I'll never make you beautiful. You cannot become more beautiful until you sit down and actually develop capacity and strength and work in yourself. That's the only way that you can do it. The only way you can perfect yourself is by actually working on yourself. And this is where things become very powerful, because if you want to be beautiful, you have to do the work. You have to craft yourself. You have to change yourself. You have to put pressure on yourself to shape yourself. And it can't be given to you by an abstraction. In fact, the only way you can become beautiful is by confronting suffering. In fact, the beautiful are often those who confront the most suffering. And not necessarily even in their generation. It might be an ancestral confrontation with suffering as well. Those who are beautiful are almost like the fruit that is born after a long tree of struggle and stress and organization in order to get things right. And Nietzsche talks about this at length. Beauty is extremely costly, and other ideals have to be put aside. They have to be put aside in order to attain beauty. All right. So in our modern capitalist world of equality and freedom, these things must be put aside if you want to make someone beautiful, if you want to make a culture and a people beautiful. Profit and wealth, these have to literally be spent on beauty, on experiments, on testing. All things, ideology of any sort, any ideal other than beauty must be put aside. And Nietzsche talks about this in the context of places like France and Greece. He sees these as some of the best cultures in the world. He actually calls them feminine cultures, because they had the sense about them to sit down and not be like Puritan, like very masculine energy of being like Puritan ideologues like you see in Rome or Germany or Judea. Instead, or the Arabs, you know, instead of moving away from that, we're moving towards a feminine culture where they sit down, they drop all ideologies except for perfection and beauty and the perfection in beauty. And we're not just talking about a bodybuilder style of beauty either. Like, France is not known for being, like, of course they have strong people, they're one of the best militaries in the world, but it's not like a conglomerate of bodybuilders. Maybe Greece was sort of like that, but France, not really. Because France was beauty in every direction possible. You hear people like Jordan Peterson talk about this. When he comes to Europe, he's astounded by how beautiful it is. And the reason why that is because for long, long centuries, many things were sacrificed at that altar. people took that stuff more seriously. Nowadays, you have people running around being YouTubers or going around setting up their Instagram profiles, and all of our sacrifices made towards these short-term successes. And by short-term, I mean in the sense of a lifetime. But back then, for 1,000 years during the medieval times, people thought about building a church over 7 generations. And the architect that would perfect all the arcs and all this stuff went unnamed, went unknown. And the whole focus of theirs was not being addicted to social media to get their little dopamine stimulus. Their whole idea was about crafting perfection in that. And then, of course, there's perfection in you and I as well. There's like the French are known for their sort of manner, their style in everything, the grace, the natural grace within them. Things like gestures, speech, the style of speaking, the use of the hands, the mannerisms, the habits, the clothing. All these little specifics are perfected, are beautified, the focus of the people. And it's like a collective conscious thing is focused on mastering everything and making it the most ideal possible. Now, this is really hard for people to follow because we actually live in an abysmal culture for this stuff. It's not like this stuff is absent. You'll go online and you'll find like lots of people, more plates, more dates. You'll find lots of people who are like bodybuilders are a good example of this, of people who are trying to perfect maybe this little area of life. And you'll go online and look at like clothes guys and tailor guys, and they're trying to perfect these little areas of life. And you just have to imagine that. Imagine if everybody was hugely into this and took this stuff very, very seriously, as Nietzsche would say. You know, in order for beauty is very costly, because people all across the entire culture have to say to themselves that they will not let themselves go, even in private, and they'll forbore profit and everything at the altar of beauty. And so what you get out of this is, after many centuries, the food ups in quality, the standards of the food gets higher, the standard of dress, even the way people look gets higher, the perfection of the clothing, the perfection of the manner, the perfection of the music, the perfection of the writing, the perfection of the language, all of this stuff raises in standards. And it's massively, massively illiberal and unequal, because it's by premise has to make distinctions. In order for you to have good culture, something that's enjoyable to live in, you need to be illiberal, you need to be against normal standards. When someone comes in and they speak a certain way, you need to have a criteria for judgment on this stuff. And this stuff is actually quite objective. It's the same way as if you go into fighting. If you want to say someone's a better fighter than another, you have to raise the standards and hold each other to a standard and see. And then one of them will be proven to be incapable, and that will be a judgment of inequality, and this is what goes into it. And it changes the whole direction of ideals. Once beauty rises up, once this natural virtue rises up to the top and starts to create in people a will to power towards high standards of behavior, everything starts to get consumed within it, and all the other values get pushed aside and get reorganized, and the hierarchy changes, and equality gets cast aside as something that you're all equal to try raise your standards, and we're not going to unnecessarily oppress you. We're just going to sort of say to you that if you fail, you fail. You're free to try, but we're not going to put freedom and equality as some type of superordinate virtue or something like this. And in fact, it's this moment is how people perfect themselves. You know, maybe you can go and you can, you know, gain political power or something like this. But after you gain the power, after you gain the freedom, as they say, how are you going to perfect? How are you going to develop yourself? How are you going to individuate as a person or as a people? How are you going to look at every little detail that you are and make it beautiful and idealize it and use yourself as a work of art and see your culture become something like this? And in order for you to get into that mind, that's just a whole crazy way of thinking that people are so bad about. And it comes back to that very first thing I was saying. It's like as if all of a sudden you just woke up some morning and you're like a perfected Buddhist and you said, man, fuck this escapism. I'm not going to run off into ideology all day. Instead, I'm just going to look around me and be like, you know, what was the first hour of my day like? What was the things that experienced that? What was it like to wake up? How could I make that bed 20% better? All the little specifics. It's just specific thinking. How could I make that more beautiful? How could I idealize my sleep? How could I idealize my looks, my face, all these type of things? How could I idealize the way I speak, the manner of thinking? How could I idealize the art of thinking? You know, like, I'm not just saying you stop thinking altogether. I'm saying you start to take this different view on everything. How could I idealize my music and my art? How could I idealize painting or whatever it is? How could I idealize administration and social organization? How can I bring quality and style and standards to everything? What happens then is you have this people, if they develop this attitude inside of them, that attack life, that confront life, and like an artist, try to impose beauty upon life, try to impose standards upon life. They try to confront life with strength and raise the standards of their existence. And what happens as a consequence is they become beautiful in every which way that you can imagine. And this is what leads to good culture, because this is what people call it, the experience of life. This is what it's like to wake up and experience and go through the joy of life, to experience a life that is full, where, you know, the manner of you and your friends is high quality, the experience of your food is high quality, your body reacts properly because you're feeding it well, you look beautiful and you feel healthy because you're in good physical and mental shape. These are all the type of things that truly will save you, truly the things you need to go for, but they take work, they take discipline, they take stress, they take attention to detail, they take sacrifice fundamentally in order to get there. Now, these realities are a very difficult challenge for a lot of people, because how do you turn that into a political program, Steph? How do I get right hemisphere about my life and raise my standards in an illiberal way? That's not really going to sell very well in a democratic society, is it? It's not really going to sell very well for political goals. And the truth is that politics and culture are like masculine and feminine forces in polarity. Nietzsche would even talk about this. In order to achieve a great political game, you almost have to go a little bit simpler, you know, more masculine, more blunt, miss out on the nuance, push forward like a ram driving to get something done. You have to make mistakes, you have to be sloppy, you have to be a bit crude and bashful. But of course, then once you've attained that political victory, in order to give it any purpose or meaning, you have to obviously start culturing. You have to start maybe opening your eyes up to subtle tastes and being a bit more open-minded and challenging your shadow and stuff like this. And this is the art of culture. This is where you get very, very right hemisphere. It's a feminine force coming into gear. And the sort of masculine purity goes away. And these two things are in sort of perpetual balance. And then maybe you'll over-culturalize and you'll get a bit sterile. And then the will needs to come back to give it a direction. And you're sort of dancing with these two things. And so the problem with something like a culture war, again, with this reactionary problem, is that a lot of people are only waking up to this stuff because the left, if you wish, have become politicized. And the reason why that has happened is because they've built this culture over a long period of time. And what's sort of been going on is people have been in the universities and they've been doing what these French people were back in the day, or these Greek people were back in the day. They're sitting down and they're trying to idealize human institutions, human behaviors. So for example, if I go in and I want to become a good singer, these singing teachers will idealize my natural ability to use my voice. They'll idealize what I am. I'm just an ape to them, and they'll try and make me a perfect ape, a better ape. They'll rise my ape quality. So when I speak, they'll be like, this is how you use your mouth to make the right mouth noises. And they have an objective pedagogy and standards that raises the quality of my speaking and my singing. Now, true culture is about lifting that stuff as high as possible and having a sense of what you're doing intentionally. As Nietzsche said, beauty is no accident. And the moral of a society is dictated on this. When you talk about something like what is right or what is wrong in decision making, what is good or what is bad in taste, this is what it comes down to. This is why Nietzsche would say stuff like morality is anti-life. What he means by that is our sort of abstract morality that pulls us up into deciding what's right or wrong in some strange ideological abstraction, instead of sitting down and dealing with life as it is and seeing that what is good and bad, what is tasteful and decrepit, what is quality and low quality. These moral choices are very obvious to us. They're just very difficult for us to accept because they impose standards upon us. This is the core meaning he's talking about. And this is what you have to do. You have to sit down and learn how to experience that criteria of life, experience that. And it's hard. It's hard to get that stuff serious. It's hard for you to deal with that. But then in the universities, in with the left and all this, they sit down and they don't want to do those standards. So what they do is they go into the universities and they grab the same institutions. They grab your language and your speech and the manners of talking and the way you think about yourself, the institution of thought. They grab on these. They go into the universities, become the professors, and grab onto these and manipulate them and perfect them and idealize them in their own image. They add into them jargon. Do you ever wonder why I'm talking about jargon? Do you think I'm joking when I'm talking about jargon? They grab this and they install inside of it little nuggets of jargon, charged jargon that means special things. And they craft the words to their specific magic language. And they start to possess the mind and they change the culture. Because this little thing, this speech, it's only a small little detail, but it's part of the culture. It's part of the experience. And then when you and I go through these universities, or we talk to an average person nowadays, our taste, the taste buds inside of us, our stomach turns. Life, nature, who has her own personal standards that we must be adherents to, she turns because she hears an ideologue, she hears nonsense, she hears jargon, and nature doesn't like that. And in fact, this is not some bullshit I'm making up. This is well known in the writing communities, in the speech communities, and the standard of speaking. If you want to learn this stuff properly, you go in. I've done this. I've learned how to speak properly. I've learned how to articulate myself properly. This is almost always said, is that like hammering people with abstractions is the least effective way to speak to them, to reach them, to spark their imaginations. That's a signal of low quality skill. Now, being perceptive enough to see this process, to see what is happening, to see that there are people out there trying to grapple language and possess it for themselves, and understand without resentment, without reactionary instincts, what is happening. Look at it as a naturalistic process and understand that if they didn't do it, something else would take its place. And in fact, your responsibility, like those French people, like those Greeks, is actually to seize upon everything in your life like this and push and impose illiberally standards upon this. Raise the quality of everything. Try to think to yourself, what does it mean to speak well? What does it mean to use language well? What does it mean to think clearly? And apply that level of penetration and sophistication to everything. And understand that if you're going to achieve greatness in a culture, this needs to saturate everywhere. Nietzsche, for example, said that when the reason why the Italians were such great singers is because all of them could sing. They were all singers. They were all interested in singing all the time, and they spent their time developing that aptitude, and out of them came great singers. It was a consequence. Us Irish are fantastic poets and fantastic drinkers. That's because we all get drunk and start rambling on in speaking in tongues, which produces this poetic quality. Maybe we tap into the primordial brain or something like that by doing this. If you want to achieve heights, you need to penetrate and saturate everything. It needs to be everywhere, and you need to have that level of obsession and that level of intensity, and you need to have this desire to possess these things, this ferociousness inside you that you want to perfect all these institutions within man. Because I guess within a community, you this needs to happen among everybody. Everybody needs to hold themselves all to this standard. That's what a sort of good, healthy society, quote-unquote, culture is. Everybody pushing up these standards, and therefore it sort of like begins to resonate out of the people. They become a great people to be around. They beautify the world. You don't build a cathedral by yourself. But of course, on some level, this does begin with you idealizing yourself, you imposing upon yourself illiberal standards, you imposing upon yourself this ideal, this worshipping of beauty, and this makes you perfect and gives you a vision of what's higher and what's ascendant and what you should strive towards. To live is to suffer. To survive is to find meaning in the suffering, to find something to fight for, to find something to go towards. And this is, like, Nietzsche often talks about the Greeks, and why are the Greeks so renowned as being these cultural successes. People, for example, often say that Socrates and all this is what the Greeks were all about. This is actually, Nietzsche disagrees with this in a brilliant way. And he says that Socrates was a sign of the decadence of Greek culture. When someone like Socrates came along and started to jargonize everybody's language, that's a signal that the Greeks were getting weak. And actually, what happens is you have Socrates, then you have Plato, and then you have Aristotle, and then the Greeks get conquered by Alexander the Great straight away after that, or Philip, Alexander's dad. Aristotle trained Alexander because he was enslaved by Philip. And it's kind of a signal that, like, when Socrates shows up, everybody looks at Socrates and being like, oh, the magic jargon of the Greeks. And, like, that's when they were great. That's the sign of great Greek rationality and intelligence. It's not true at all. The true ascendant phase of the Greeks was before that. That was the end. That was sort of like what's going on now. Socrates was like the original critical theorist. He was the original jargonite, the original leftist, I guess you could say, or something like this. And this is not the phenomenon that you're looking for. You're looking for something before that. You're looking at the Greeks when they were sort of in this mythological entrancement, before they were rationally neurotic. They were sitting around and they had this energy, this fury inside of them, as Nietzsche would talk about. They had this aggression where they wanted to compete against each other, and they were getting these flashing images inside their heads, like psychotic schizophrenics, of these beautiful ideal forms and figures, like the great, you know, good-looking statues that they all built. And this was giving them an ideal. This was giving them a physical manifestation of a higher man in front of them, a higher version of themselves in front of them, a perfection of themselves that they could strive to achieve, a physical image, and a whole host of different gods that they could worship, gods being idols, being ideals, that they could charge towards. And this, it was sort of like a race among them all to become the most godlike that they could possibly can. They were chasing after the gods. They were trying to, in some sense, evolve, like the way animals do. Like the way you can think of evolution as a neutral process that just happens. Imagine if you grabbed that and you said to yourself, I'm going to perfect everything about myself, and I'm going to augment as close as I can to these ideals I have in my head, these images of perfection and whatnot. And people will obviously look at this superficially because they're superficial themselves, and they'll say, oh, well, they're just like the Greeks are just all trying to be bodybuilders. But the Greeks were known for having a comprehensive attitude towards perfection and education of the individual. They taught their children music, they taught their children philosophy, they taught their children speaking and rhetoric skills, oratory. They taught them, of course, physical culture as well. School for them back then was the gymnasium, strength, athletics, music, thinking, speech. All of it came together because all of this stuff is relevant, because when you're trying to create something excellent, when you're trying to take a husk of a person, which is what you were born as, an untrained entity, and you're trying to take that and perfect it and rise it and make it into something higher, you need to train everything. Everything, every little detail needs to be attacked, it needs to be assaulted, it needs to be put together. And this takes incredible will, because the way you fight a culture war is you have to have this level of ferocity inside of yourself. And this is like waging a battle on 1,000 fronts. It is very, very difficult. But if you can find, if you can allow yourself to have the imposition of that ideal upon yourself, if you can see perfection and higherness and ascendancy and the image of something better inside of yourself and impose that standard upon yourself, you can actually do what is needful and improve yourself and see yourself grow in all these different ways and become a sort of rippling effect. And imagine if you found 1,000 people like that. What would it be like if you could, what type of culture you would form if you found enough people who are into self-improvement and self-development, and what that really means, not some, you know, LARPing about it or attaching to the jargon as people often does, but actually doing the needful stuff and perfecting the institutions within you, your strength, your health, your speech, your thinking, your clarity, the way you do everything, manner, clothing and behavior and knowledge of the world, interaction with the world, all of these things. You have to attack everything. I hate to break it to you, but everything has to be lifted up in this way. And this is why it's such a monumental task. What this finally comes down to is the common question, because what we think of as culture is things like art. Things like things that we create, artifacts, if you want to put it this way. And the culture wars wrapped around this is like, what do you do? Like, we'll start memeing on the internet, is what people say. We'll start going out and doing this type of stuff. We'll make YouTube videos. We'll start another podcast that gives out about the left and all this stuff. And the thing is that this is not culture. What I described to you is the true process of culture. And when you do that properly, you start to impose that will to standards, that will to quality upon everything you do. And of course, you impose that upon the aesthetic experiences of art. And this is how you start to form really great art. If you listen to a classical symphony orchestra and compare it to anything that's coming out nowadays, I know it's snobbish. You know, it's not that the stuff nowadays doesn't have its spirit and its quality. Like, I can find beauty in modern music, but you listen to it qualitatively and you're like, that's they were a people at their peak. In the 19th century, listening to some of the stuff that they produced there, you're like, those guys hit levels that you just don't see nowadays, because people just don't have, there's nothing, people aren't just trained to that comprehensive level. People just don't get as serious about that stuff. There's something higher about, you know, getting 400 people in a room that have all perfected their craft, and having one guy organize it all and spending his whole life and dedicating towards this perfect creation of sound that goes on in something like a symphony. Even think about the sort of way that symphonies happen. Like, musicians now, we think of them as like 20-year-olds that are like running around rapping, and like usually they're very low skill people. But again, if you think back in the day, what's the image you get of a composer? Someone who's mastered the craft of music, mastered the specific thing that is music. Well, what age? You think of them as like 50 or something like that, because that's how long it takes to get something like this right. I guess the similar analogy would be like a movie director or something like that. Like, that's the vision you can have of someone who hits that high ideal. And of course, this brings up the question about quote-unquote culture. What can you raise to that level of standard if you want to produce, if you want to be an artist, if you want to be a creator, if you want to be all these type of things? Well, first of all, reacting to the left is not culture. Watching, Shapiro's thing, Daily Wire, is not culture. Sure, you can put this stuff up if you're upset. It's not like there's anything wrong with speaking the truth in some sense, but it's not doing what is needful. Just being a proud person who speaks the truth is not doing what is necessary. The only thing that is right to do is to raise standards. You have to start raising aesthetic standards. This is personally what I'm pushing for in my life. I want to create high quality artistic works. I would like to get into filmmaking and whatnot, because I see that as a great opportunity to raise standards and tell stories well that have never been told before. But at the same time, I can't sit down there and say, you know what I'll do, I'll like make a political YouTuber, I'll like make this type of stuff. That's reacting to the current trends. And as I said, maybe some people will be destined to go into politics. Your path might be slightly different. There's no problem with that. This is how you have to have this dynamic, nuanced style of thinking, where you can see there can be different paths for people to go. But ultimately, if you want to do the cultural thing, you can't be in that reactionary state where stuff that you create is a complaining about what already exists. That's not culture. In some sense, I guess it is, but it's a signal of weak culture, of sad culture. There's no ferocious artistic possession there. There's no intoxication by an ideal that you're chasing after. The filmmakers of nowadays, they're chasing after the perfect movie. You, what are you chasing after? Conservatism, traditionalism, Jordan Petersonism. Like, that's not a fertile cultural ground. You know, you have to think about what's the thing you're charging towards? What's the ideal you're trying to reach? That's ultimately the only thing that's going to answer that urge inside of yourself to lift those standards. And at the same time, people say stuff like, the left is creating all the culture. The left isn't really creating any culture either at the moment. I haven't seen anything really quote-unquote new happen, per se, in about 20 years, and that's basically my whole life. Like, I can't, like, you know, Eminem and hip-hop was the sort of peak of that, and then Kanye West, and then, like, what's really happened? Has music got a new trend at all? What's changed? What's going on? There's nothing going on. Like, everything just sort of became weird. This is the only way you can describe it. Maybe I'm a boomer. Like, maybe this is just a big, long boomer confession. You're going to watch this back and be like, what a boomer. I was like a boomer confession there. He just said, I finally hit the age of boomerism mentally. You know, he's a mental boomer now or something like this. But there's sterility in the culture at the moment. And I think that's what you're suffering from mainly. And the left have, what they're creating is an expression of their pain. You know, they are, as Nietzsche would say, they are the degenerate man, the person who suffers, and they don't have the strength to impose standards upon their life and change the reality. And so what they do is they escape into an abstraction, and they ferociously escape into the abstraction because they're fired up, animated by their resentment towards life. And then, of course, they impose that resentment upon the world and their ideology, and they try to change everything to suit this. And this is what's going on here. And you know, to an extent, some of that stuff comes out, and they might produce cultural stuff, but they're not really producing anything new now. Like, they're as stuck on YouTube as anybody else. They're stuck doing podcasts on YouTube, talking about things. Political commentators, general social commentators, social critiquers. Like, none of that stuff is culture. People don't look back, per se, and, like, really get into that stuff too much, you know? There's great writers tend to be more stylistic, more artful. Nietzsche, great writer because of his artfulness. These type of things. You look at the cathedrals, you look at the paintings, you look at the music. That's the stuff that stands the test of time. Critiques don't really, you know. They struggle. They really labor under this type of pressure because most of it is just crap. Most of it is just complaining. Life doesn't enjoy information guy like me. That was depressing. Doesn't enjoy information guy style people. Doesn't enjoy people who complain and whine and critique. What life expects is someone who succeeds and does, who raises the standards, raises the game, or dies trying. That's what she's looking for. And I guess this is the sort of generalized problem. This is the issue that we all have, is the moral ferociousness. And I don't mean abstract morality, which is bad. I mean in this sense of like the ferociousness for you to develop a conception of taste, to have standard upon things that you do. That requires a will to power. That requires a vitality. It requires strong energy. This is really what's missing so much. And because we lack strong energy so much, we are suffering in and of itself. In fact, you could say the resentful preachers of equality exist because we lack vitality so much. But if we can reignite that vitality, reignite that spark that gives us that ferociousness, that gives us that desire to attack life, to confront the suffering of life, which would then lead us to that idea of, if we're going to fight life, we need to have a vision of perfecting life, an Übermensch conception in our head. This vitality, if it was strong enough, it would push us towards this, which would lead us on the right path towards ascendant and higher, growing and high standard culture. But this is one of the greatest problems that we face. This is one of the ones that we struggle with the most. The question of vitality sits as the most important thing on all of our tongues. How do we create health inside of us? Look, think of how topical that idea has been for the past 2 years. And it is legitimately a archetype we must confront. Vitality and health. How do we achieve this in a realistic and headed way? And this is a great challenge. And this is a cultural problem that we face. This is the sort of premier issue. The lack of vitality, which leads to the lack of grounded idealism, which leads to a lack of production of high quality artistic works and whatnot. These are very, very big and challenging problems. And so if you're in that position where you want to fight in the culture war, you want to save the West, you should think about revitalizing it, giving it spirit. It's not about going to the past and conserving something because people like Vaush made videos that upset you or something like this. It's not about doing that. It's about you going and saying to yourself, wait a second, how do I give birth to life within me and then let that life express itself through me to create something that's, you know, standing on the past but moving towards something new, trying to reach the ideals that they reached, trying to reach that spirit that they reached, or find that spirit that they found, but of course finding it for your own age and your new age and whatnot. And this is ultimately how I see it anyway, and I've been brainwashed by Nietzsche, so keep that in mind. But I think this holds an important set of ideas to reiterate. Do not be reactionary on any circumstances. You want to pause when you find yourself acting reactionary and think from the ground up what you need to be doing and what it means to be creative, what it means to change the culture. Because sitting around and having loads of people who don't like the left or something like this it's not going to get you anywhere. You're just sitting there, you're just annoying to listen to. You're as sterile as the people you claim to hate. And ultimately, if you want to produce something, you would sit down and you would realize how hard it is to make something. Right now I'm sitting down trying to figure out what it would be like to make a little animation. Tiny little animation. And it's just so hard to get all these things put into place. It's difficult to raise your standards. And to talk about an idea of like a film or something like that, to have the right for me to to have the right for me to create something where I can express my spirit through it, which would carry my values, of course. For me to earn that right, there's so many things that I have to get good at. There's such a high imposition of standards upon me. And I like that. It annoys me all the time. I'm like, oh, I wish this was easier, but it couldn't be any other way, and I understand that. And unless you're able to digest that level of struggle and that weight of an obstacle and beat that obstacle and actually produce something without complaining, you lose the right to be upset. You are simply an annoying reactionary, and that's something that you have to overcome in yourself first. You could describe it for Nietzsche as, in Nietzschean terms, as the resentment we're trying to crush, and the resentment people often accuse the left of being full of. So that is that. Let me give you a positive model of what this could look like using history, because an awful lot of you are reactionary creatives like myself. you know, and it's something you kind of have to overcome in yourself to be truly a creative who sets a new path forward. You have to kind of say, all right, I don't want to be too reactionary, but you're reactionary for a reason. Like, you wanted to get into the arts, and what was cool in the arts was, you know, you had the hip hop scene, you had the rock scene, you had, you know, Rage Against the Machine and all this type of stuff, and you've kind of grown up now and you're sort of realizing that Rage Against the Machine is like raging for the machine, like caged in the machine, I don't know, and you're kind of thinking to yourself, nah, this is, wait a second, and then you, all this ideology stuff shows up and it's penetrating all the arts, and the arts are just crap. Like, I've spoken to screenwriters in Hollywood and stuff like that, and they're like, it's actual junk. Like, yeah, I'll write something and then I'll send it to the execs and then they'll tell me I have to add in these things to fit the ideology and the message you're trying to put across. Like, the art is dying there. It's becoming sterile because it's becoming Socrates. It's becoming ideological. It's becoming, you know, word salads as opposed to the energy, the vitality of truth that is necessary for life. And this happens, you know, this is just the way societies work. This is the way things work, you know. I hate to say, but you're in a decadent time, as they might say. But this has happened many times before, and people have started from nothing and created new cultures quite a lot. Actually, one of the best ones to study is hip-hop. You know, hip-hop. Maybe you're expecting me to, like, be like Ben Shapiro and be like, hip-hop's not real music. But this is not true. Hip-hop's a really well put together culture, and it happened organically as well, which is even better, you know, because this is sort of what you want. You want a natural energy, like a passion erupting up, and then you want people not to stifle it like Socrates and fill it full of jargon and kill it off, but you want them to in some sense consciously grapple onto it and then ride it like a surfer riding a wave or something like this. And so hip-hop was born out of the ghettos in the 60s, 70s and 80s, and you had a load of like black people who were disenfranchised, and they had no way to get into white culture, and they couldn't afford guitars and all this to participate in the music stuff. Rare occasions they could get them, and so they had to deal with whatever they had, you know, in order to produce something, in order to express their vitality, because these people lived, they lived in the ghettos, and they had vitality running through their bodies, and so they were like, oh, we want to dance, we want to start creating energy, we want to express our energy in a very simple, innocent and naive way, we want to express ourselves. And so they go and they get like record players, vinyl players, and they start coming up with scratch mixing, which is just a very casual way of grabbing these big vinyl players and like ripping, destroying the thing, but in order to get that repeated beat, so you have a nice and you just scratch over that to keep that loop going. And then, of course, guys just get a microphone or maybe they don't even do it without it, and they just start rhyming on top of it. And all of a sudden there you have, you know, a beat and words, and that's enough for music. And that starts to turn into the very, very early hip-hop culture. You have an MC, you know, a guy who stands up and hypes the crowd, gets the crowd all hyped up, and you have someone scratch recording behind it, and boom, you have the black people in America creating their own culture, creating their own movement. And it takes years for this to kick off. But they're letting the energy carry them through, and it becomes more mature and articulated. You listen to early hip hop and it's very kind of new and fresh and clunky and messy, you know, and this is an awful lot of what this reactionary culture is like right now. It's clunky, it's messy, which is fine because it's vital. But over the long enough time, you see people like Biggie Smalls show up. You see people who actually take it to an art. You know, you listen to them and you're like, man, these guys are like really nas. Very high quality. Like, they're actually starting to develop this into something that you'd listen to. And this is around about the 90s. And this is when an awful lot of people started to get into hip-hop. It's actually set up the modern paradigm. Hip-hop and kind of really depressed punk rock sort of stood as the two dominant forces in the 90s, and things haven't necessarily changed that much. And then and this is where you see all of a sudden you have this culture that started in the ghetto among a load of broke motherfuckers who were like sitting around making tracks to just like have a party on the block, as they say. And graffiti comes along with this as well. All these like really, it was very punk rock in this type of sense, like these really city, urban, down to earth movements or whatever. And then now you have these guys who are perfecting it. You have characters like Biggie, Nas, Eminem, and all this stuff. And I don't know this stuff inside out. Like, I have obviously a shallow view of it, but like, you know, I'm telling you what I see. And then out of this, these guys start to do really well. You know, Biggie's living in a mansion all of a sudden, and of course this is pretty good. It's a vital culture, is now carrying some of its members to the heights of society, a signal of its success. It's making people successful. It's creating an identity for black people in modern life. These are all good things. And then, of course, what comes out of it is people like Jay-Z, Kanye West, as we talked about, Eminem. These guys basically get superstardom up at that point. Jay-Z is a billionaire now. Now, you think about that. In the 80s, how was the 80s? 50 years ago, you had, like, you know, I don't think there are many black billionaires. Let's put it this way. And then they are now, after going through this, like, through this culture carried them to the absolute apex, to the absolute peaks. And it was their energy properly economized and sent in the right direction. And now they stand sort of in a position of great status and great success. They've really, like, the culture's really carried them in a great place. And you see many of their adherents do really, really well, which is brilliant. Like, good for them. And this is a new, organic, authentic culture that was born out of this. And it stands as something, it's a very interesting experience and phenomenon. And then another example is the Irish. I talk about the Irish the whole time. Same sort of thing. The Irish were oppressed by the English for 1,000 years. It's the, you know, the spiel, like, wow, 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 I'll take a couple of shots and give out about it and all this. But in the 19th century, we were pretty pissed off about that. We had just been famineized. We'd just been starved by the Brits. And so what happens is the people in Ireland, the poets, felt bad for us. And so you had people like Yeats, you had people like the various poets, John Kavanagh and all this type of stuff. They're boyos you probably won't recognize. But anyway, these guys were all sitting down and saying to themselves, all right, what does it mean to be Irish? And this is where we sort of come up with the Celtic identity. And so these guys all get around and start to create a culture where they're sharing poems and sharing ideas and researching Irish myth and researching Irish music and standardizing an awful lot of this stuff and creating this a collection of things that represent Irish culture. So you have, for example, the Celtic ideas, the colours, the stories of Tir na n Og, the fairy tales, the sounds, you know, that sound, that typical sound you experience. All of this stuff is crafted here and really given resonance and power. And Yeats distinctly is like in the centre of this, and it creates this big image of the Celtic identity, the Irish person who's separate from the Anglo-Protestant, the Irish Celtic, Hibernian, whatever character. And this is really strong and pregnant. And all the music you listen to, Irish trad music, if you listen to it, it's not necessarily like, you know, 1,000 year ago trad music. It's basically music that was freeze-framed to the end of the 19th century, because this is when they standardized it. This is when they really got into this stuff. And these artists came together and built up this vision of the Irish identity. And then this carried an awful lot of energy forward. This culture created an identity. And the identity gave political focal point, gave them something to gravitate around, to rally around. And this is what allowed them to push forward against the English, which eventually got them their freedom. And this is how this stuff often happens. And it's an incredible story when you really look at it. Like, what a crazy thing to free a nation from another, a superpower as profound and majestic as England. And there's hundreds of examples like this. Another one would be maybe a bit more controversial, but the Italian futurists are all Nietzscheans, and they used to run around Italy before Mussolini. They used to run around Italy, and they were all making this art that was really modernist. They were like modernist. They were actually like progressives, is the way you think about them. And they were making all this art that was trying to like get people fired up. They'd like do these art shows and try and go in, make all these crazy arts with these sharp young angles. They were big into like energy, so they'd make all this art with like daggers in it and stuff like this. And people would come in and they're having like this schizophrenia. It's like taking speed or something like that, looking at this art. It's all sharp angles. You're like, what the hell? What's going on here? And they'd try to hype them up and get them to start a riot, and it was like sort of politicized and all this. And these guys basically created a huge amount of energy that the fascists like Mussolini capitalized upon and took to its political end, if you want to think about it this way. And as I said, these things have happened before in thousands of different ways. The Romans, you could look at it, the Jews, you could look at it, you could look at the Germans, you could look at any people, and not just people, but movements within people and everything. There's all these instances of culture. The French Revolution, you could say, was a load of people in super successful France got around and sat in coffee shops, drinking coffee for the first time, getting wired off enlightenment ideas and sort of deciding that they need to reorganize society along the principles of equality. And then boom, you have after that cultural moment, you have the French Revolution actually happening. And out of that comes Napoleon, and it's just crazy the way all that stuff worked. But this is how this stuff works. And you sort of sit in this situation where you're restricted to something as pathetic as being reactionary. You know, like, you've no idea how profound the destiny of that energy you're feeling is. If you're feeling that reactionary energy, it's sort of you saying you want to create something new, you want to go in a new direction, you want to stand and produce something of beauty and majesty, something that's righteous, something that reaches for eternal truth. That's really what that's trying to say. It's not, you don't want to, you know, you're not a Ben Shapiro fan. That's not what your identity is. Your identity is reaching down to the very depths of your soul and trying to define yourself as like, how do you fight suffering with beauty? How do you create something of beauty that justifies the pain and the suffering that is life? And if you can pull that off, and if you can really find that, you can create inside of people meaning and energy and a positive, first principled, affirmative direction that will pull them towards something that they believe in. And God knows it could even achieve political goals that you care about, but I just don't recommend you go too crazy focusing on that, because you should really think about this stuff from this energetic perspective, like an artist in some sense, like someone who's, you maybe have to approach a more feminine, you have to be searching for energy, and you're trying to grab onto that energy and understand that energy, understand the energy like an emotion or a passion, something you can articulate and something you don't really want to articulate. You're like the artist who's trying to grab that energy and bring it and give it vision so people can see it. And then weirdly, you create this artifact, these symbols, just like the hip hoppers did. They create these artifacts, these pieces of music, and when people listen to it, they don't understand what it is, but it brings energy out of them, it excites them, it awakens the passions. And this is right, this is how it has to happen, this is the correct way for it to do, and this is your project, this is you as an artist, this is how you do this stuff, this is the process you need to go through. But it's a very delicate thing, and you have to get it right, and sitting around watching Daily Wire is not getting it right. Now, Nietzsche, like, people give him an awful lot of hassle, but he's almost like a mindset coach. He's almost like a stoic mindset coach. He installs mindsets inside of you to help you think a certain way. And, like, I'm joking, but I actually think that's very serious. Like, he, from reading him years ago, he made me look at things a certain way, and he made me very wary of these type of patterns. And I never, you know, it's hard to articulate them. I can articulate them now better than I ever could, but enough, when I felt these reactionary feelings, as we all did, I got a little bit suspicious, you know, and I kind of took a step back, and I was sort of like, wait, is this what I want to be, you know? Should I just go up on YouTube now and build a YouTube channel, and then just become like, you know, network with Ben Shapiro and become like a Daily Wire Part 2 or something like this? I don't think that's the way forward. And I start to think to myself, like, what are the things I'd like to create? What are the things I'd like to do? So I'm interested in art. I'm interested in creating something that's genuinely unique. I'm here like a talking head, and this is a great existential fucking struggle for me. Like, I'm here ranting about all this stuff, organizing my thoughts like some type of YouTube philosopher and all this. And it's like, is that the legacy I want to... Is that really landing a knockout blow in this problem? Is that the legacy I want to leave behind? Does the world need another YouTube podcaster? You know, we're all doing it, I guess, so that's the reason why it's showing up, but... Is that really it? Is that really it taken to a high art? Like, in my mind, I'd love to go to the direction of making films or making something that allows me to get my aesthetic vision onto the page. Music, film, whatever it is. And just go all in on that. That would be one thing I'd like to create. Now, the other problem is that, like, I am very much a jargonite. I have got, like, a blather brain inside of me. I'm sure you've noticed. And I have to, like, part of me has to fulfill that side of myself. And I have to figure out what to do. And, like, you're kind of charged with this problem of trying to pick an identity. Like, what do you become? So I have that part of myself. And I love diving into knowledge and sharing into knowledge and coming to understand stuff properly. And so, like, one part of me wants to create this vision of this extreme aesthetic victory and create something new and be part of something new and be part of something futuristic and not something sterile and boring and crap. And then another part of me wants to create something as well. And this would be like an institution of sorts. And this is what I'm trying to do with the Boyo program. And I'm trying to think it through very, very severely and down to earth. Like, what could I offer that's not out there in the world? And something that happened to me during my life is that I went to the institution where you're supposed to get educated. Because think about what I'm talking about. The whole point of this is you go in and you get crafted. You get idealized. You get perfected. And that's what education is designed to do. If you're in education in ancient Greece, they installed you with musical skills, with speech skills, with fighting skills, with training skills. But I went to the education system and I felt I wasn't good enough. I felt I suffered because of life. I confronted the problems of inadequacy. And I wanted to change. I wanted to improve. And it was a good instinct inside of me. I really wanted to become someone better. I wanted to idealize myself. And I couldn't find anybody to help me do that. I went to one of the biggest colleges in Ireland. And I could not find... I was looking for it everywhere. And I just went in and it was just jargon after jargon. And it was probably there somewhere, but it's like, it was a pretty hard look. It was like running through Hogwarts and trying to find a secret door. Went in, it was Marxist theory. I went in and there was Judith Butler. I swear to God, I go in and I'm having this stuff hammered down my throat and I'm being told this is what we're going to install inside of you. And I was like, I don't want that shit. I want skills. I want aptitudes. I knew I was inferior with speech. I knew I had no style. I had no creativity. I had not economized my passions. I was not put together. And I was like, you know, at least it had a gym. So that was the first time I properly saw a gym, because there was never any gym where I was growing up. And so I started going to stuff like that, but there was no, like, who was teaching me how to articulate myself? I was reading all these books by these book copers, and I'm like, how do I write a damn book? How do I learn to speak and all this stuff? So I was jaded, man. I was running through this education system trying to find this stuff, having ideologues try shove their jargon down my throat, telling me the Socrates is all this and that. And I'm there, I drop out, and of course I start reading Nietzsche, because I'm like, man, he's the only one who actually can write well. God bless him. And then eventually he just, like, that's his little in, you know. He writes kind of cool stuff. You're like, oh, that's good. And then he grabs you with his intoxicating writing, and then you're just fucking brainwashed. You're just like, you're a Nietzschean running around giving out about reactionaries on YouTube 5-10 years later. You're like, oh my God, what's happening? But this is what I did. I dropped out, I started reading Nietzsche, and then I went out and I actually found people to train me in skills, train me in capacities, train me in competence. I went out and I was like, is there anybody out here who can actually install inside of me, like, speaking skills, write anything? I went to poets, I went to musicians, I went to jazz musicians, opera singers, jazz singers, rock singers. I went to everything. I went to public speakers, people who did these open mic nights, comedians, salesmen, lawyers, people who just did like toasts, like stuff like this. I went to everything. And I was like, teach me something that will just make me more articulate and organized. And it was a very messy curriculum I sort of made for myself. I was just running around trying to find as many free things as I could, and then the ones that cost money, I would pay them. And I was just trying to improve. And an awful lot of that stuff served me so well. I learned so many important things. I learned so many things about how to think and how to write and how to articulate yourself that really just served me incredibly later in my years. It's a great source of creative freedom for me to achieve my creative potential, a great source of financial success, a great source of general freedom and charisma with people. I'm able to talk and people listen. People, like, I'm the articulate one. And I was not always like that. You know, I trip over myself often, and I've gotten way, way better in all this. And these are all, like, skills that I've gained and grabbed and seized and learned. And this is what I'm thinking about with the Boyo program, is putting together something that trains this inside of people, because an awful lot of people suffer. I've done this stuff now for over a year and a half, and I've spoken to an awful lot of people, especially coming from that game of psychology. So people are coming in and talking about their struggles, and what I see the most is people suffer because they're incompetent. They suffer because nobody has ever taught them how to raise their standards in a comprehensive way. And so I think one of the most simple ones that people struggle with is being heard and being understood and being able to articulate themselves and being able to take the ideas in their head and articulate them in such a way that it turns into freedom, charisma, interaction with people. There's great satisfaction in being able to talk, being able to communicate what you see and how you see the world. And it can turn into, as I said, wealth and all these type of things. And so something in me deep down is like, man, could you create like an alt university, a Boyo university, a Uber Boyo program that can actually take people in and take them through that process of teaching them all these skills so that they come out at the end with a skill that's very, very practical and level-headed and easy to see, that solves problems like feeling imprisoned and struggling and emotional problems, because it gives them power and it empowers them to assault the world, to launch themselves upon the world and create stuff, and then they'll be happier as a consequence of this. And so this is my big focus now going into the next couple of years. I've kind of like failed my way forward in many ways, stumbled an awful lot, and now I'm sitting down and thinking to myself, all right, what would be the big victories? I want to do stuff artistically, and I want to do stuff institutionally and level-headed. I want to teach people skills and educate them and build out a program that does this, and then I want to focus on making art and all this to entertain, to ignite the passions within people, to increase the vial of vitality. And I think this is me, and maybe I'll have to make a choice at some point between those two, but this is where I'm at the moment. So we'll see how it goes. fingers crossed that all goes well. Now, if you want to develop this capacity and these skills to attain these things that I'm talking about, like, sign up, come in, apply for a call, you'll sit down, chat with one of my boyos, and you'll come on board. We'll talk to you about how it all works and how this stuff can get applied to your life. And then come in and we'll actually train you. We'll train you in these skills, all the skills that I picked up, all the skills that I've used to become successful, all the skills that you should be getting taught in education system in universities. You know, they used to teach this stuff. This is the whole, the word education means to draw out, to educate, to draw out, to take out your capacity. This was known as classical liberal arts. And it's just not taught anymore. And I have this opportunity now where I can build basically a school that can teach you this stuff in the context of the modern world where you have this ability to interact, and you can go and use this stuff and really pull yourself out of that problem of the struggles of modern life and incompetency and not being able to get these ideas. It's like a missing thing. Everybody's going towards tech because tech is where the game is at, and there's nothing wrong with tech. Tech is very, very interesting. Or everybody is, I don't know, going towards entertainment, but no one's sitting down and thinking in terms of qualitative skills anymore. So if you want to gain those and gain power, power that can allow you to influence the world, sign up below. You'll do a call. There'll be a link down below somewhere. There'll be a link, I'd say, down there or down there. I'm pointing deeper down there, maybe in the top comment or something like that if this is on YouTube. Go in there, sign up for the call. You'll chat to one of my boyos. He'll explain how everything works and we'll go forward from there. So thank you very much for your time. Stay juicy. And I guess bye-bye.